This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is June 18th, 2020, and this is episode 194.
I'm Scott Delonabome.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, Blockhouse leader Alain Therrien. Therrien?
Alain Therrien, I think, is how it's pronounced.
There we go. Thank you. He doesn't think the RCMP is racist, so Jagmeet Singh got kicked out of the House. And a roundup of other news and smaller stories of the week. Thank you to the 100 people who are contributing every month. Our newest patron, Trask, pledged us an awesome $50 a month and threw another $25 a month towards Canby Report, where content will be coming soon. As well as to Stephen, who sent us $30 by e-transfer. Join them to keep us growing at patreon.com/politicoast, or if you also want to send us an e-transfer and avoid the Patreon fees, you can send that to our email at leginbootmedia@gmail.com. And if you can't remember that, just send us a message and then send us money. For the duration of the crisis as well, we've opened up our patron Slack to all listeners. Visit leginbootmedia.ca for an invite. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. We had a little bit of feedback after last week's episode, which I think importantly followed with the previous episode, 192, where we discussed policing and Black Lives Matter issues with Stephanie Allen. I think there was some question about whether two white guys is the best to discuss policing issue, discuss some of these issues. And I don't know what your thoughts on that, Scott, were, but I mean, the kind of approach we've always taken with this podcast has been, it's kind of our hobby horse of just trying to present issues. And as much as we can, we do try to bring guests and outside voices on, but as two people with full-time jobs, that's sometimes difficult.
Yeah, I think we struck the right balance on this by and large. I mean, we did get one email discuss, wanted to raise the issue that, yeah, two white guys talking about this, particularly with respect to police in schools might not be representative. And I mean, I hope I made it clear when I was talking about it that that was really my experience and it wouldn't necessarily be applicable to all people. And that, you know, being a white guy at a very white school in Sydney is definitely not the universal Canadian experience.
Yeah, there was a nice piece in the Burnaby Now by a black grade 12 woman who spoke about the fear she personally experiences and the day-to-day racism she experiences and why that kind of drives her to not want to see armed RCMP officers in her classroom, say, on a day-to-day basis. I think following that as well, there have been motions in Vancouver from the Elementary School Teachers Union. A number of cities across North America are kind of reflecting on this. I've seen some cities are pulling police from schools in the interim while they review it. Other places are just starting reviews. I was also thinking we'll just throw a bunch more links in the show notes here. The book End of Policing by Alex Vitale. I'm being awful with surnames today. It's actually free right now to get the ebook copy. And a lot of people reference that one when they talk about defunding or abolishing the police. Alternatively, there's a Vox review that's a bit more critical of it, but, you know, we'll put those links in the show notes.
Yeah, I thought the Vox review kind of did a very good job at looking at it and kind of discussing what the literature says around police and their effectiveness and how it relates to a bunch of different issues. So I definitely recommend that. As well, when we're talking Vox, the last couple episodes of The Weeds, their podcast, have also had, I think, quite a good discussion on policing. So we'll throw a link to those episodes too.
And finally, there have been a couple more people speaking out. Perry Belgrade, National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, has called for an overhaul of policing. Canada's first Black police chief, who was Devin Clunis from Winnipeg, has raised that he thinks there's too much essentially we need a better approach. I think people are being over-policed, or police are being asked to respond to things where it's not appropriate. So the conversation's continuing. We're going to move on to other topics today, but, you know, I'm sure we'll come back to this sooner or later, particularly as the province moves to review the Police Act. Well, moving into our main segment of the day, it's okay to be racist, but not to call someone racist in the House of Commons. There was a bit of a kerfuffle yesterday in the House of Commons as Jagmeet Singh brought forward a motion to review the RCMP's daily budget, call for them to be accountable to the public, release use of force reports, and just do a full review of the RCMP. And I'll play most of the debate that we got into was in French, but we'll play the audio clip of Jagmeet Singh's motion and him seeking unanimous consent from the House.
Mr. Singh, I'm used to being in committee. The Honourable Member has a point of order, please.
Oh, my apologies. It wasn't a point of order. I also have a unanimous consent motion. Is it the right time to rise on that? Okay. There have been consultations, and I hope if you seek it, you will find unanimous consent for the following motion. That the House recognize that there is systemic racism in the RCMP, as several Indigenous people have died at the hands of the RCMP in recent months, and call on government to do the following. A, review the nearly $10 million per day RCMP budget and the RCMP Act. Increase non-police investments in non-violent intervention, de-escalation, and mental health and addiction supports. B, ensure that the RCMP is truly accountable to the public. C, release all RCMP incidents of use of force reports and the associated settlement costs. And D, immediately launch a full review of the use of force by the RCMP, including reviewing the tactics and the training that is given to RCMP officers in dealing with the public.
Does the Honourable Member for Burnaby South have the unanimous consent of the House to move the motion?
Yes.
Agreed? Oh, I'm sorry. No? Okay, we don't have a unanimous consent, I'm afraid.
So you could hear at least one member deny unanimous consent, and from the debate we can tell that was the Bloc Québécois House Leader, Alain Therrien, and allegedly he made some kind of dismissal motion to some of the chatter, which you could hear in the end there, towards Jagmeet Singh. Somewhere in there, I couldn't hear it, I couldn't make it out, Singh said he was a racist for doing either that dismissal motion, or for just voting against a review of the RCMP, one which the Conservatives were in favor of, the Liberals, the NDP, the Greens, really everyone. No one was really opposed to this except Mr. Therrien. But because Mr. Singh implied someone was a racist, another Bloc MP, Claude de Bellefeuille, the MP for Salaberry-sur-Aa, rose on a point of order to say he'd insulted a member of her party. She goes on to say he shamelessly called the member racist. It's unacceptable in the House. There's an acting speaker in the chair at the time who said she personally didn't hear the comment. We'll have to listen to the recording and then discuss it, and asked Jagmeet Singh if he wished to make a comment, to which he says, Madam Speaker, yes, I did call him a racist, and I do believe he is. So if there was any ambiguity or doubt, he just took the chance to get rid of that. He was asked to apologize, and he said, Madam Speaker, I will not. To which the Bloc Québécois member stomped her feet, got very upset, and demanded he be removed from the chamber, which he was at 3:15, 45 minutes later, when the Speaker, Anthony Rota, returned. And then Singh had to spend the rest of the day hanging his head in shame, speaking to a lot of press who were like, why were you kicked out? It's such a thoughts, reaction, Scott.
So before we get into this too far, like, I think it's important that we, you know, say that, like, you know, he's the first person of color to lead a major party. he's honest, coming from this from a, yeah, I think a pretty honest and personal place, and that's how he perceives it. And that, you know, there's, as we've been discussing for weeks now, and actually longer than that, there's, you know, very clear problems with race in Canadian society that need to be discussed. So yeah, all of that said up front, but now we have, I think I also have to consider where the House of Commons is and what it's like as an institution. And, you know, it's an institution that considered fuddle-duddle to be unparliamentary language. So it does have a very low bar for this sort of thing. And it's fairly easy for less controversial accusations to raise the ire of the Speaker and other members of Parliament.
So I pulled up the actual rules and the standing orders for the House of Commons. The rules of order say under Section 18, disrespectful or offensive language, no member shall speak disrespectfully of the sovereign, nor of any of the royal family, nor of the Governor General, or a person administering government of Canada, nor use offensive words against either the House or against any member thereof. In other words, you can't insult the Queen, Prince Philip, any of the other monarchs or royals, the Governor General, or anyone else in the House. Only the last one really tends to come up. Part of this, and you see this in basically every rule, set of rules of order, Robert's rules and other things, the idea is the debate in the House should be about the ideas and not the people in there. It's the same reason they're not supposed to name one another. They're supposed to speak about the member for so-and-so I disagree with their idea, not I think they're a callous pig and should be, you know, a joke. Nevertheless, people always skirt this line. Standing Order 11 also gives the Speaker the ability to name individual members for disregarding the authority of the chair. In this case, this is the order that Anthony Rota invoked, partially because he was ordered, Singh was ordered to apologize, and he refused to. So he, in a way, publicly and openly attacked the authority of the chair, as the member from the Bloc put it. But like, as you point out, Singh is the first National Party leader of who's a person of color. His profile, when you go to Twitter, notes that it's pronounced Jugmeet, despite the fact everyone in the media, or many people in the media, keep saying Jagmeet, and I'm trying my best. And he's, you know, he's spoken a number of times about the racism he's experienced both before politics and since. So this is definitely a very personal issue for him. And, you know, we don't know exactly what the Bloc House leader did motion, but there is a long documented history of these kind of microaggressions where people of color's opinions are kind of dismissed or with either a sleight of hand or other gestures. So, you know, I don't blame Jagmeet for reacting strongly and to try and call it out. And honestly, when the rules say you can't call it out, sometimes breaking the rules makes it a better situation for you, since we're able to, you know, highlight this in a way that if he'd done, as I believe Tom Mulcair suggested, and apologized, most people would have moved on pretty quick. I mean, we're only a day after, and by next week, people will probably have moved on, but it went a lot bigger than it would have otherwise if he'd followed the rules to the letter.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I've seen a lot of people comment somewhat to the effect of, well, this is the Parliament considering it's worse to call someone a racist than to be racist. And that's not an unfair criticism. Like, I, as you mentioned with the rules around decorum, and it's a very common thing, pretty much every legislature and every decision-making body everywhere, that there are these limits on attacking other people's character among the members. And we can discuss whether or not that should be revised, but, you know, within that context, I don't think the Speaker of the House was necessarily wrong, even if quite a few people, I think, fairly point out the outcome isn't entirely great on that. And I'm not sure it's how really to resolve that, because we could, you know, as a country decide that the rules of the house should be different, but that does raise the potential issue of having a debate that is a lot more personal than politics already is, and that might not necessarily be a great outcome. So it's a tough one, and maybe the way it should be handled is that these things get discussed outside of the house, because nothing's stopping anyone who's a member from going to the media, posting on their own social media to accuse other members of the house of being racist, just not on the floor.
Well, libel laws apply outside the house. Inside the house, they're protected by parliamentary privilege, so they can say anything and not be sued for it in there.
Although I think it's pretty unlikely that that would actually be upheld.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't be any legal consequences to it.
Yeah. Although we have seen various politicians try in this country frivolously, seemingly, to sue one another for defamation outside the house, even in the last couple of years. Poor, bad legal strategies aside, though, Yves-François Blanchet, the leader of the Bloc Québécois, was asked about this incident, and you know, he went to bat for his house leader, saying he's not a racist, he likes everyone. Quebecers come from a nation that is open, welcome, and generous, and that likes diversity. Which, he likes everyone is not really... It's weird. It's a weird statement. I struggle to understand why they oppose this motion. Why the Bloc? Like, doesn't
it's not necessarily being the party that does,
or this individual member, because doesn't the Quebec has its own police force? Why should they even care what a motion says about the RCMP?
Yeah, I'm not really clear either why that position was taken on it. I don't think it was the full position of the Bloc, more the individual member there, and who knows why.
Well, it did, I think, ultimately work out fairly well for Jagmeet Singh. I think we've seen over, you know, the last couple of years, particularly in the election, and now when issues of race come up, he's one of the strongest voices nationally. Like when Trudeau's blackface incident or public was being discussed during the election, it was Singh who didn't like actively try to take advantage of it. He as much as he said, you know, I want to talk to all the kids, you know, all the brown, all the black kids out there, and he just tried to have a heart to heart. And I think even his post press conferences after this ejection mirrored that sincerity, which is refreshing to see in a politician, at least.
Yeah, he's definitely at his best when talking about these issues. And the NDP under his leadership struggled to connect in a lot of other ways, but when the conversation shifts towards these, Singh definitely shines.
Well, I want to turn in this conversation just to close out with some fun examples of other times people have crossed the line of decorum, as it were. We previously discussed some of this way back in episode 61, titled The Minister of Silly Names, when Speaker Daryl Plekis was forced to rule about whether the insults and fake ministerial names being thrown at each other were parliamentary language or not. And I think he ruled a number of them crossed the line. But Canadian history is littered with some great examples, and many of them come from right here in British Columbia, most notably when former Premier Dave Barrett was in 1983 dragged from the legislature. So he'd refused to leave after being found to breach decorum, and three officers, from including the Sergeant of Arms, had to pull him out of the legislature after a ruling. This was during a particularly contentious era when Bill Bennett was trying to really drive the province's spending down and drive us into austerity, and Dave Barrett, as the leader of the NDP, wanted to just fight that. So yeah, he was dragged out of the legislature and didn't just leave peacefully, as they usually do. Another really good one that I enjoy is from 1964, when Riel Caouette, who was the head of the Quebec Social Credit Party, and Social Credit was a very strange movement. He'd previously...
We should do an episode on that at some point.
Yeah, Alberta Advantage has done a nice pair on the history of the Alberta Social Credit, which was one of the more racist and economically cranky ones. BC's was a bit more of just the, you know, the old ND or the old BC Liberals. It was just the people who weren't NDP.
I've tried to read the Wikipedia on the underlying social credit theory, and like 2-3 times now, and I just end up walking away, scratch my head, trying to, because I can't make heads or tails of what they actually thought.
Yeah, the first underlying theory is anti-Semitic, so from there it doesn't get much more coherent. But Cahuete in 1964 was debating with the Tory leader Louis-Joseph Pigeon, and Pigeon had called Cahuete the Canadian Mussolini after he had previously expressed the qualities of Mussolini's leadership and Hitler's economic reforms. Pigeon was asked to clean up his language and said, "I believe you are right, Mr. Chairman. I did make a mistake when I said the honorable member for Villeneuve is a Canadian Mussolini. I should have said a Canadian Hitler." It's just nice when you can call your opponents Hitler and not be totally off base. You mentioned the fuddle-duddle one. That one was more Pierre Trudeau silently mouthing what he later said was fuddle-duddle, but most people believe it to be the obvious fuck-off during a debate. A fun federal incident was in 1985 when BC New Democrat James Fulton was in a debate over fisheries, and he apparently did cross the floor and placed a salmon on the Prime Minister's desk trying to protest some of the sockeye fishing restrictions on the Bibeen River. You're also not allowed props in Parliament or to cross the floor like that. So he got kicked out for all kinds of reasons. And then, you know, we'll throw a link in the show notes to both these stories that are from Tristan Hopper's 2016 piece, as well as a piece from iPolitics about all the words you can't use in Parliament, which are legion. I think you can say legion, but you can't swear. I'll do a lot of swearing. So yeah, don't call anyone a racist in Parliament. And ideally, don't be a racist in Parliament, but that's not as likely to change anytime soon.
Moving on to quick takes. The Trudeau government finally announced when we're actually going to start to see some of the financial numbers after, well, everything that's happened. So Minister Morneau announced that there's going to be a fiscal snapshot, which is not a term that's been used before, as far as I know. That's going to be released on July 8th. It's, rather than the fiscal update, which typically includes 1-year, 3-year, and 5-year projections, this is likely maybe just a year's projections, if that.
I mean, Morneau's defense here and claim is that providing a fuller update would be, quote, unrealistic right now because of that requirement to project ahead so far, which he says we simply couldn't make any responsible predictions about. You know what? He's not totally wrong.
It's not entirely unreasonable, but, you know, there may be something that's beyond just like a 1-year gap, but just has very big error bars on it. Yeah, I presume there's a decent graphics person somewhere in Ottawa who could convey that decently on a chart or two in the fiscal snapshot.
Yeah, both the Conservatives and Bloc have criticized this for both being insufficient and for being dropped in the middle of summer. Yeah, you know.
I think both points seem reasonable.
It's not like the Liberals have a better option. Should they delay it till the fall? Like if they release it, they're not going to be able to pump something out in the next week. So, or at least not something as robust. And early July isn't that far away. So, well, at least we'll get some update about the fiscal health of this country. The other challenge for Trudeau this past week has been that his efforts to get Canada back on the UN Security Council or back on the world stage failed quite spectacularly this last week.
It turns out Canada is not back.
Yeah, there were 2 seats up for grabs and 3 contenders, Norway, Ireland, and us. Norway got the most votes with 130, Ireland pulled 128, and Canada got a measly 108.
Which is actually down from the last time we tried to get a Security Council seat when we got 114 but lost out to Germany and Portugal.
I saw a lot of people retweeting the Liberal Party of Canada's official tweet from the time when they were pointing out that Stephen Harper was the only prime minister to ever not win a Security Council seat in Canadian history.
That's not true anymore. Now we have 2 prime ministers.
That did not age well.
No, really didn't.
The government ultimately spent more than $2.3 million on this campaign. There were a number of trips to Africa where I think we were really hoping to sweep up some votes.
Yeah, that, a large part of the campaign also got cut short Trudeau had to cancel a bunch of overseas trips he was planning because of COVID.
It's unclear how much of a difference that would have made.
I don't think it really would have saved it.
Most people can't name the non-permanent Security Council members. I think a lot of people would struggle to name the permanent ones if they can't remember their high school's social studies courses.
It's the US, Britain, France, China, and Russia. And the five permanent members get vetoes. Nobody else does.
You know, it's kind of a black eye for our international efforts, but not a knockout. I think there were some questions raised about Canada's climate record on this. A number of countries have a number of reasons they may or may not have voted for us. So
yeah, everyone basically took their standard ideological frame and just applied it to this question. So there wasn't much useful about that because you can't really know why the other countries didn't vote for us.
I mean, honestly, I might have voted for Norway and Ireland. They're both pretty cool countries, so glad to have them there. Yeah. Congrats.
But yeah, I think this does kind of raise a bigger question, which is just kind of what is Canada's foreign policy and why did we even bother trying to win this seat? Like, we're 5 years into the Trudeau government. Like, they've never really articulated a coherent foreign policy or kind of what Canada's major interests are and what are the necessary steps to accomplish them. And they just kind of seem to bounce around from, well, trying to keep the NAFTA trade deal intact, and then what can probably be best described as trying to recreate like the Pearson era glories, but without actually doing the hard work and just kind of putting on the aesthetic of them.
Indeed.
Canada is a country that just does not discuss foreign policy well, and governments rarely feel the need to articulate that well. Well, following up from our discussion over the last couple of weeks about policing in Canada, there's a new report out by the RCMP around use of force. This was reported on today. I haven't actually been able to track down the actual report itself. It doesn't seem to be published online anywhere as of recording. If we do find it, we'll throw it in the show notes. So it looks over the last decade, and particularly the period 2017 to 2019. And the takeaway headline on this is that the primary means of what they call intervention tactics or use of force involves brandishing of a firearm and pointed at a person.
And it's notable that RCMP have multiple other options than pulling out their gun, whether that's a taser, doing a number of other soft control, for example, physical interventions. Many carry pepper spray, as we've seen in use of force in BC, batons sometimes, police service dogs in other cases. The default doesn't necessarily need to be pull out the gun.
Yeah, so on average, there's about 2.8 million calls the RCMP responds to. Of those, about 2,215 on average require or involve some use of force. I shouldn't say require, because that isn't actually specified in here. And yeah, of the period looked at, there were 5,441 instances of pointed firearm, 3,062 brandishing a firearm as a deterrent, and 33 officer-involved shootings during that period.
I think we saw in data we discussed last week, or possibly the week before, the number of CBC had done an analysis looking at the number of people killed by police across Canada, and BC had among the highest per capita rates and almost per total numbers overall. None of this should be that surprising. I am hopeful this starts to prompt some level of reform or review, at least. Like we've been discussing, there are a lot of places or a lot of instances when police are being called when that's probably not the best response.
Yeah, so I believe the RCMP has some version of a use of force continuum, but looking at this, the pointing of a firearm at someone is second only to the use of lethal force, i.e. firing the firearm. And it does kind of make you wonder why that one has the highest rate of use rather than a bunch of the other options. In theory, one would suppose that the distribution of incidents is not necessarily clustered at the almost need to use lethal force end of the continuum.
I mean, the simple answer is that there's a culture where pulling a gun is viewed as the smart, safest thing to do, because that escalation immediately makes it clear who is the dominant power in an interaction versus other approaches that are involve more de-escalation or trying to calm things down aren't necessarily being preferred by individual officers when they get on the site. So not a case of a few bad apples, a case of, I think, a systemic issue where the, you know, majority approach or the major approach is escalation, not de-escalation. And that's a really difficult thing to change over with just, you know, some reforms to training and things like that. You know, I think we need to take guns out of a lot of hands of officers and stop calling them for, or have other people respond in many cases. That's kind of the first steps it will take.
I lean a little more towards for more training as a solution rather than immediately disarming, but there's definitely reforms needed, and spent most of an episode last time on that. So in the interest of time, I think we'll probably move on to the next one.
Yeah, so we have kind of a pair of Supreme Court rulings that have come down from different levels that could possibly help a number of places where people's rights can be better protected. First, coming from the BC Supreme Court, the Civil Forfeiture Act has been struck down. I think we've talked about this in the past. This is a...
Yeah, we had an interview from the BC person from the BC Civil Liberties Association several episodes ago. We'll throw a link in the show notes to that.
Yeah, if I can find it. The Civil Forfeiture Act essentially allows the government of BC to seize property that has been believed to be used in crime or connected to criminal activity. It's been largely criticized as a way to take people's stuff without having to prove that they've done anything wrong. The case in question involved the Hells Angels, and I believe the government had seized three of their clubhouses. And ultimately, Justice Barry Davies of the BC Supreme Court ruled that the act was unconstitutional because it intruded on the federal jurisdiction of the criminal law.
Yeah, basically it was making criminal law at the provincial level, which is a big no-no. So yeah, a lot of the discussion the last few weeks has been on policing, but there's other aspects of the justice system that also need reform, and civil asset forfeiture is a big one. And a huge part of it is that it doesn't actually require a criminal conviction or proof beyond reasonable doubt to affect what are significant criminal penalties. People have had their houses seized, vehicles seized, you know, significant things that, you know, they need for their lives, as well as, you know, a significant portion of a lot of people's property. And that should also be protected. So, you know, reforms are definitely near the provincial level, and it's good to see this get struck down.
Yeah, it remains to be seen if the province appeals this, and it could change directions at higher level. But yeah, this is a bill that kind of crosses party lines in this province. The BC Liberals have moved actions like this. The current act was put in place by the BC NDP. And so sometimes it takes the court to really uphold these kind of rights. The other case that came down was just this morning, was the Zora decision from the Supreme Court of Canada. This was a similar case dealing with people who haven't been convicted but are facing some sort of punishment. So in this case, Chasen Zora was accused of possession for the purposes of trafficking, and they were on bail, and the police were coming by their place every day, almost at different times in the evening, to check his compliance with curfew. He was required to answer the door within 5 minutes of them knocking. And there were a couple times in 1 month when he claims he couldn't hear the knocking because he had guests, and later he installed security cameras to help alert him if someone was at his door so he could go answer the bail hearing. And it basically got to the point where it was so onerous on this person that he argued, I'm not trying to breach the bail conditions, so why are you punishing me so much? And the Supreme Court of Canada ultimately sided unanimously with that position, saying the standard that's been applied to these bail conditions shouldn't be this purposeful one. There should be a more subjective and look at on a case-by-case basis. You know, you can't just apply a one-size-fits-all bail solution or bail provision to every person who's being charged and released. You got to look at the case-by-case basis, and therefore, otherwise you risk disproportionately affecting vulnerable and marginalized people especially. So ultimately, you know, this is one the BC Civil Liberties Association is celebrating. Good news, I think.
Seems like a reasonable outcome.
I mean, it's another one of those ones where the civil liberties and rights aspect conflicts with what was a popular conception of being tough on crime or not really having much sympathy, because Zora may have been a drug dealer and people don't generally sympathize with people who, you know, knowingly break the law. But until, you know, they always have rights. Even, you know, before they're convicted, they're presumed innocent. You can't treat someone so cruelly until they're proven guilty. And even then, they still have rights. So, you know, good work, courts.
Well, moving on to one final court case in our court tapes today. The Supreme Court Chancellor ruled that BC violated the French language education rights of British Columbia. This case specifically involved the funding of BC's only French language school board, and the outcome was that they had to pay $6 million in damages and $1.1 million to cover operations. This was brought by a parent who sued due to inadequate provision of busing to schools. The more significant aspect of this is that it will likely require the province to significantly expand its French language education offerings across the province.
Yeah, the sections of the charter that I almost never pay any attention to are, you know, sections 16 through 23, which are the official languages and minority language education rights sections, because, you know, I grew up in Alberta. We're in BC now. These are very English dominant provinces, but under our charter, there are protected bilingualism. There are rights for French minorities, and there are rights for English minorities in Quebec. It's the only French majority province. And so these cases can come up where there is a small French minority population in BC, and they do have a constitutional right to have their own schools and their own education programs. I think in Alberta, it's largely done through French immersion programs and stuff like that within the main public school system, although I imagine there are a few French-only schools. Here in BC, there's an entire school district that's the French school district, but it covers the entire province. And I imagine there are a few French immersion programs as well, but there's going to have to be more, as you say. And so, interesting ruling, and one I definitely wasn't following.
The article specifically mentions Burnaby and Western Victoria as places in need of French schools to be built.
Maybe my child will go to a French school when she's older.
Honestly, I kind of regret not learning more French when I was going through school. I mean, I kind of hated the French education we had here, but honestly, wasn't very good. But after graduating and joining the military, it was definitely the case that I would have benefited from having a much better French language knowledge. So, yeah, good that they're going to be expanding it in BC.
Yeah, I agree. My French education was not great. I do still kind of sympathize with the idea that in BC, there might be other secondary languages that are more valuable than French.
They're definitely more commonly spoken languages. There's only about 65,000 Francophones in BC.
Well, there you go. Moving on, though, there's what Angus Reid Institute is reporting as a shifting support for basic income in Canada. They have a new poll out, which actually does a nice comparison with some numbers they have from 2016 about the support for a basic income at the $10,000, $20,000, or $30,000 a year rate. They don't delve too much into all of the other nuances of a basic income, which I would encourage listeners to go back and listen to that bonus interview we had with Lindsay Tedds about how many questions you should be asking when people bring up the idea of a basic income, whether you support it or oppose it. But it turns out 60% of Canadians, roughly, are in support of a basic income.
Yeah, although when you ask if they're willing to pay more taxes to fund a basic income, that number flips around, pretty much doing a 180, where 64% would disagree with that.
Although 61% are in favor of taxing the wealthy to do it. The most notable or interesting stat I saw under who should pay for it was that those who make under $25,000 were the most willing to have their own taxes raised, and that support actually just dropped as it got to the wealthier and wealthier people. It's the wealthiest who both were the only income demographic to actually split evenly on support for a basic income, and who did not want to see taxes raised. Regionally, it was only in Alberta where there was a majority who opposed a basic income. It was 42 to 47% there. By party, the NDP was the most enthusiastic at 84%, the Liberals at 78%, and only 26% of Conservatives supported a basic income. And I also saw that men were more likely to oppose a basic income than women. I mean, both had strong support, but 35 to 40% of men, depending on the age bracket, were opposed, as opposed to 20 to 26% of women.
It's kind of roughly what I would have expected before looking at this.
Yeah, nothing particularly jumps out. I think the support is higher than I would have assumed, although in several categories, it's actually gone down quite a few points since 2016. At the $30,000 level, for example, 67% of people in 2016 supported a basic income, and only 59% do now at that level. It's worth mentioning $30,000 is only slightly above the poverty line, I believe. It's not a lot of money, especially if you're in a major city like Vancouver.
Yeah, but it, at the same time, it represents a very significant outlay, especially if it's done at a universal level rather than a targeted program.
But in any case, these are reassuring numbers for any politicians looking at expanding CERB and making it more permanent.
Well, possibly. I mean, the split between willingness to pay and support for it is very stark. And once that becomes a real live political question that's being debated, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, where there's a concrete proposal on the table, I wouldn't necessarily assume that those support numbers for basic income stay as high as they are. I mean, if you poll people, if they ask if they want free money, it's generally going to have very high levels of support for it. It's interesting, but it doesn't tell you that much at when it actually comes down to implementation.
Well, we'll have to see what comes down when the basic income panel returns its report here in BC later this year.
Looking forward to that. One place that is getting more money from the government is BC Ferries. So after BC Ferries announced several weeks ago that they were going to have to start curtailing 11 minor routes, the BC government has finally stepped up and provided an additional funding of $180,000 to kind of bridge over until September, when things are going to be reassessed and hopefully BC Ferries is in a better financial position. So these are specifically the routes to Salt Spring Island, Powell River, Tetsuda Island, Gabriola, Denman, Hornby, Quadra Island, Cortez, Slattery Bay, and Haida Gwaii.
Yeah, many of the smaller routes that, if those aren't supported, people in those communities are going to be hooped because they won't be able to get off, get resources or service or supplies. And so these are an essential bit of our transit infrastructure, and keeping BC Ferries afloat is a necessary move. You know, TransLink is necessary, but yeah.
They've seen 80% drop in ridership and are losing roughly $1 million a day. That's what's been estimated.
Now we just need the full official bailout of TransLink, because all we've had is a promise and statement that they won't go under. Well, but speaking of getting things going again, the BC Greens have restarted their leadership race officially. They announced earlier this week that their contest was reopened as of June 15th. Candidates can still join the race, which currently consists of Sonia Firstenow and Kim Darwin. Go back and listen to our Sonia Firstenow interview from a couple months ago, I believe, and we'll try and get Kim Darwin on the podcast, and anyone else who wants to join the race. You have until July 27th. If you want to vote in the leadership race And if you want to vote by phone, you should join by August 21st. If you want to join to vote online, you have until September 2nd. Voting is September 5th to 13th, and we will know who the new leader is on September 14th. And there will be a all candidates debate on September 1st. Hopefully we can do something fun for that.
Sonja Forstner really is the front runner on this, and I'd be surprised if it's going to have a different result, but yeah, nevertheless, these leadership races are interesting to watch.
People can sign up as just a supporter to vote in the BC Green leadership race, so you don't need to be a full member to vote. It could be that Forstner is busier with duties in the House, and Darwin is able to leverage her connections and pull it from behind, but you know, being an elected member does give you quite an advantage in these situations. Compare it to the federal Green leadership race, where there are 10 candidates who most people haven't heard of, who are all struggling to kind of get their name out there, and none have been elected federally before. But we'll keep our eye on both of these races and the Conservative race that's also going on.
And yeah, today was the English language leaders debate. We're not talking about it too much on this podcast. We'll probably discuss it next week. I will note, for a party that is based in Western Canada, they didn't feel the need to schedule their debate at a time where all Western Canadians were off work, which isn't great.
Well, maybe they want to expand beyond Alberta and Saskatchewan and some of BC, and therefore make it a little easier to listen to in Ontario and Quebec. They also weight their votes by constituency, so those voters out east matter more than member-rich ridings out west.
True, although there are some probably fairly member-poor ridings out at the very west. I did manage to catch a little bit of it before we started recording. Nothing really all that standout about it. But I think we'll be discussing the leadership race in full. Platforms have started to drop. So yeah, we'll take a look at that probably on next week's episode. And finally, the provincial governments announced that they are going to be letting restaurants buy their liquor at wholesale prices to help ease their financial woes. So up until this was announced, the BC restaurant industry did not have access to wholesale pricing. Because we have a centralized government distribution center, everyone has to buy from the single provincial distributor. And until now, the provinces basically used that as a cash cow and charged retail prices, i.e. what you would buy at a liquor store just as a normal customer, rather than giving the restaurants the same pricing that the stores themselves buy at.
Yeah, this is a really common sense, simple change to help an industry that is really struggling right now. It's bizarre that BC was doing it another way for so long. I mean, the money is the clear answer there. In many places, alcohol is like the cash cow of the restaurant industry and the bar industry. But when you have to buy from like the front side of BC Liquor, you know, $1.50 a can or more for beer, sometimes $2, $3, and then you sell it for $5. You're not making as much as you could otherwise be. So,
yeah, like the restaurant industry is not an industry that has high margins. Even when people aren't being kept away for public health reasons, the margins are thin. There's a very high rate of failure in that industry. So it never made much sense at a policy level besides just being a way for the government to kind of squeeze as much money as they can out of business owners. Shouldn't have taken this long to adjust it. And like just at a basic like fairness level, it didn't make much sense that one category of business owners, the private liquor stores, could buy the same product for significantly cheaper than another category of businesses. So welcome change. Shouldn't have taken a pandemic for this to happen. And even then, it's only temporary and it's going to be reviewed in March.
I can likely see this sticking around as one of those temporary changes made permanent. But, you know, anything could change. You know, I'm also hopeful maybe we see a slight decrease in some drinks and you're not paying $7 for a beer and maybe you can pay $6.50.
Yeah. So there's no requirement in this that the savings get passed on to customers, and like the government's expecting that this is basically just going to help keep struggling restaurants slightly more solvent during these tough times. But yeah, once things go back to a, you know, previous level of business, yeah, there's hope that competition and lower costs could help push the prices down a little bit for consumers.
Anyway, make sure to order a nice meal every now and then if you can afford it from your favorite local restaurant. Use their online delivery service if you can. Try to avoid DoorDash and skip the dishes, other than to maybe find a new restaurant because of some of the profits they skim off the top. Or, you know, use the new socially distant seating arrangements that are being set up at many of these restaurants. Go out for a nice meal if you feel safe enough to do so and can afford to, obviously. Keep the businesses running.
And that has been Plagueghost. Find links to everything we talked about at plagueghost.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/plagueghost. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Plagueghost is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.